I'm David Hatfield, and this is Classical Music Connection. Major support for Classical Music Connection is provided by Matinee Musicale Cincinnati. Let's find out what's on today's program. In the September 2022 edition of the BBC Music Magazine, we get to interview rising star violinist Elly Konsta. Where were you born? Corfu, Greece. What's your career highlight so far? Creating my own group, her ensemble, and putting on our first gig last year. It was the first time I felt total freedom of expression, and is all the more amazing given that during the pandemic, I was receiving funding from Help Musicians just to stay in the industry. Who is your musical hero? In classical music, Patricia Kopuchinskaya. I love her authenticity. She pushes boundaries and expresses herself unashamedly through her art. What would be your dream concert? This is tricky. I'm not sure what style of music it would be. Anything where ego goes out the window and performers and audience become one. In the BBC Music Magazine for September of 2022, Terry Blaine describes a seminal music event that took place in September 112 years ago. A queer mad work by an odd fellow from Chelsea. Herbert Brewer's comment on hearing the premiere of Vaughan Williams' Fantasia on a Theme by Thomas Tallis undoubtedly ranks as one of the more flippantly dismissive put-downs in music history. Brewer was the organist at Gloucester Cathedral where the Fantasia was first performed on the 6th of September 1910 as part of the Three Choirs Festival. The new work was a festival commission, and a large audience of 2,000 was present, mainly because Elgar was conducting his oratorio, The Dream of Gerontius, in the second half of the concert. While Elgar drew heavily on the orchestral palette of 19th century composers such as Wagner and Richard Strauss, Vaughan Williams looked much further back in time for his inspiration. As co-editor of the English Hymnal, published in 1906, he had come across a set of tunes by the English Renaissance composer Thomas Tallis, written for the Archbishop of Canterbury's Psalter in 1567. One in particular caught Vaughan Williams' attention, the tune to Psalm 2, Why Fumeth in Sight, the Gentle's Spite, in Fury Raging Stout. This solemn, timeless melody formed the basis of the Fantasia on a Theme by Thomas Tallis. The style of Fantasia Vaughan Williams adapted as a model was not the full-blown tone poem of the Romantic era, but the more intimate-type composers like Purcell and Locke had written for string consort in the early Baroque period. Vaughan Williams' Tallis Fantasia was accordingly scored for strings only, using two main groups of players, plus a quartet of soloists. Vaughan Williams was 37 when he conducted the Fantasia's premiere, and most of his major masterpieces were yet to be written. How would the audience react to this new piece by a composer whose reputation was in large part still to be established? Would a work which drew so obviously on the past strike listeners as disappointingly retrograde compared to the progressive music of Schoenberg and Webern? Much of the reaction was, in fact, in the opposite direction. In the audience that evening were Herbert Howells and Ivor Gurney, both aspiring young composers. Howells was thunderstruck by what he heard in the Talas Fantasia. "For a music-bewildered youth of 17," he later wrote, "it was an overwhelming evening, so disturbing and moving that I even asked RVW for his autograph and got it." Howells and Gurney walked the streets of Gloucester into the early hours that night, excitedly debating what the Talas Fantasia might mean for the future. Press reaction was enthusiastic, too. The Manchester Guardian immediately recognized that the Fantasia was something special, quite out of the ruts of the commonplace, as its reviewer put it. The Daily Telegraph agreed, calling the piece extremely beautiful to such as have ears for the best music of all ages. That timeless quality also impressed the critic of the Times, who found the new work full of the visions which have haunted the seers of all time. These predictions that the Talas Fantasia would stand the test of time have proved accurate. The work's evocative string writing, drenched with memories of a golden past and luminous in texture, has gradually come to define the idea of Englishness in music. It is surpassed only by The Lark Ascending in lists of Vaughan Williams' most popular pieces. The work has the solidity and grandeur of a cathedral to which its strains seem to belong by a natural affinity, one commentator has written. It has passed into the repertory of all the great orchestras of the world. In the BBC Music magazine for August of 2022, we get to interview rising star accordionist Ryan Corbett. Where were you born? Glasgow, UK. What would be your career highlight? Winning the Royal Overseas League competition and becoming the first accordionist to be selected as a BBC New Generation artist. Although the classical accordion has been spreading throughout the UK for some time, it is a great honor for me to present it and its music to such a wide audience. Who would be your musical heroes? Of performers I've heard live, it would be pianist Mikhail Pletnev. What would be your dream concert? To play before an audience of great composers who lived prior to the development of the classical accordion. Hopefully they would write for it. Are some pieces easier than they sound? And if so, are they worth tackling, or are they just for show-offs? In the April 2022 edition of Pianist magazine, Warwick Thompson investigates and finds that things aren't so black and white. Being something of a bibliomaniac, I couldn't resist the alluringly haphazard display in the window of The Sanctuary, a Dickensian-looking second-hand bookshop in Lyme Regis, where I was holidaying. The interior proved to be even more invitingly shambolic than the window. It was a real curiosity shop of bookish treasures, piled willy-nilly and any old how. You really just had to let your nose guide you. Mine led me to the basement. There I found 6 or 7 wide shelves full of piano music, but much of it at a level that I didn't really think I'd be able to tackle. Lots of the flashier list, some crazy-looking Scriabin, the Tchaikovsky Concerto. Yes, I know there are others, but I mean that one, and so on. I picked out a few nicely bound volumes of Schumann and took them upstairs to the desk. If you're wondering what all this has to do with easier than they sound, then bear with me. There is a bit of method to the madness. The owner explained that all the scores had belonged to Joanna Leach, a concert pianist who had lived nearby. Would I like to take the whole lot, from all those shelves, to keep it all together, for £50? I nearly dropped the Schumann on my foot in surprise. What an extraordinary bargain! I spent a moment mentally rearranging my music cupboards at home, and then, of course, said, "Yes, please." Do look up Miss Leach at joannaleach.org.uk, by the way. As I discovered, she was a fine performer, often on square pianos, with a rather unusual career. A delicious factoid about her: her grandmother had studied with Leschetizky in Vienna. It was when I was sorting through the mountains of dusty scores, and thankfully finding few duplicates of material that I already owned, that my eye came across Liszt's concert paraphrase on Verdi's Rigoletto. I didn't know it at all, but in another corner of my rackety career, I happened to be an opera reviewer, so I couldn't resist seeing what Franz had made of the vengeful hunchback. It looked like a mad, even hallucinogenic rhapsody of a piece, beguiling and dreamy, based on the famous quartet. And here we get to the nub. I wouldn't have dreamed of trying this piece in normal circumstances, but now it was sitting there, calling to me. So I slowly, very slowly, played it through, thump, thump, crash, splat, a few times over the next few days, and then, in a fit of optimism, mentioned to the editor of Pianist that I was surprised it wasn't quite as hard as it looked. "What a great idea," she said, nosing out an article. "Why not write about what makes a piece easier than it seems?" And now we come to the reason for all the preceding me, myself, and me again, which I usually try to avoid, because the first point which occurred to me when tackling this subject is that the question of ease or difficulty is entirely relative. For someone at entry level, a simple sonatina by Kuhlauer might be a challenge, but still less hard than they feared. The criteria would be completely different for a well-seasoned professional. So what's my level? It seems only fair to try and fess up. I really had to think, how does one judge one's own abilities? I rarely perform for others. I play a lot of Bach, Mozart, and Beethoven, and practice regularly, but I'm fairly sure I'll never be able to play any of Chopin's Opus 10 Etudes at full speed, although I do enjoy trying. Above average is probably a fair summary. So, from my above-average viewpoint, when I'd crawled through the Rigoletto paraphrase a few times, I thought, hey, it's sort of doable. Maybe I could work on it. The runs and sequences sit neatly, for the most part, under the fingers. The double thirds are easier than Chopin's. The left hand isn't overtaxed. It was at this point in my relationship with the piece that I spoke to our editor. But what a difference a day makes. The very next morning, I had a few more sessions with Liszt's court jester and increasingly felt that the joke was on me. What had seemed doable after a couple of attempts seemed preposterously insurmountable after a few more. The more I tried, the worse it got. My optimism had trumped my realism. Those doable thirds would never be even. The chromatic scales had odd little twists in them that wouldn't sink in. Pah! But then, I thought later, nursing a consolatory cocktail, isn't that how all practice works? In the initial phase of fingering and slow practice, all improvements accelerate at a rapid rate. You feel hopeful. This is when you say, maybe it's easier than it looks. And then you hit the plateau. Improvements decelerate. The grind begins. Your mood plunges. You scream obscenities at your fingers, at Liszt, at the cat. Maybe in that sense, every piece is easier than it looks, until it isn't. Quite a paradox. I wondered if Dame Google would give me any assistance. Interestingly, most pages which respond to the search easier than, not as hard as it looks, are aimed at the beginner, lower, intermediate level. Fear release seems to be the main show pony for that group. Plunging a bit further down the online rabbit hole, to continue the zoological metaphor, I came to the result Piano for Show-Offs at ask.metafilter.com. It gives a fascinating set of suggestions for pieces with a high reward-to-effort ratio, for those at a higher intermediate or advanced level. I'll give a few examples here. Linus and Lucy by Vince Guaraldi. Sweet, Opus 14 by Bartok. The Stars and Stripes Forever by Vladimir Horowitz. Malaguena from Sweet Andalusia by Ernesto Leguona. My Favorite Things, arranged by Stephen Howe. Liebstraum No. 3 by Liszt. Polonaise Fantasie by Chopin. I spluttered my Cosmopolitan all over the keyboard when it came to the last item on the list. In any list of pieces which demand the most intense and searching effort, Chopin's Polonaise Fantasie would surely be included. The Horowitz called forth a snort, too. Surely this is for the most super-advanced technicians. Clearly, one man or woman's meat is another's poison. I was back to the drawing board, and I realized I needed some more help, so I called Lucy Parham, pianist extraordinaire and a thought-provoking contributor to this magazine, and asked what she thought about the topic. As you might expect, she approached it from the perspective of a career pianist, and her ideas were intriguing. "You've really hit on something that isn't acknowledged much at top levels," she said. "But it's true that in the case of competitions, for example, certain pieces have a much higher chance of winning. Liszt and Rachmaninoff, say, rather than Brahms or Chopin. It would be harder to win anything playing Chopin's Fourth Ballade than a Hungarian Rhapsody of Liszt." This immediately suggested the opposite side of the coin to me. Perhaps then some pieces, like the Chopin, are harder than they look. "Yes, if I venture to put my head on the block, I'd say it's much harder to have a successful interpretation of the Fourth Ballade. If you've got a good technique, whether you were lucky to be born with it, in the way that a sportsman or woman might be born flexible or strong, or whether you worked hard for it, you'd be able to give a good account of certain pieces. But that will never be true of, say, Chopin's Polonaise Fantasie. Works like that take a lifetime of study, and they tend not to win competitions." "Does this mean that certain pieces are therefore lesser works? Is there a value judgment to be made about crowd pleasers compared with more intimate and interpretatively demanding pieces?" No, not at all. There's a place for everything, but I think that a performer needs variety. If you played Liszt all day, every day, it would be like eating dessert all the time. I must say here that I'm a great Liszt fan, and do play lots of Liszt. And let's not forget that Liszt wrote lots of contemplative religious works, too. I'm talking about the flashy pieces of Liszt, and if you only played those, that could be limiting. And you get to a point when you think, I've had enough sugar. I need to get back to fruit and vegetables. And the fruit and vegetables are? There is no greater reward than poring over every bar of, say, late Beethoven or a Chopin sonata. It's a lifetime of study. They are pieces you learn when you're young and that you bring all your life experiences to when you return to them. You grow with that piece, and it doesn't leave you. But those are the sorts of pieces which tend not to be the audience lollipop pieces. She then goes on to talk about the issue from yet another side, about pieces which seem relatively easy, but are in fact bear pits for the unwary. Couldn't resist another animal metaphor, summary. You probably know the famous quote of Schnabel about the Mozart sonatas. Too easy for children, too difficult for adults. There's simply nowhere to hide in these works, and they're so sparse, so naked. You need a perfect quality of touch to make all those semi-quavered sequences shine. They should sound like pearls dropping onto velvet. But they're so hard to play without one note bulging just a little. It's like the finest embroidery. You always know when there's a stitch missing. In Mozart, you can hear the stitch missing. In many works, you can give a 6/10 performance, and it will be fine. But Mozart must be 10/10, or it won't work. I dare to ask her, which pieces, then, can she hide in? Which are the ones which will survive a 6/10 performance? Well, there are certain pieces I like to start recitals with which aren't so exposing, she says thoughtfully. The Bach Busoni Chaconne, for example, is a great starter, and I used to open a lot with Liszt's variations on Bach's Weinenklagen, Sorgen, Zagen. They are pieces which let you warm up. It's rather like the opening of Rachmaninoff's second piano concerto. One of the reasons it's so grateful to play is that the warm-up is written in. After those opening chords, you can't really hear what the pianist is doing for the first 4 minutes or so. It gives you an entry into the piece. Compare that with the exposed opening of the Beethoven No. 4 concerto. That really is the ultimate example of sparse writing being as terrifying as possible. Now, this may surprise you to hear, but no one is likely to come knocking on my door anytime soon to beg me to perform Beethoven's 4th. But until Parham had mentioned it, I had thought, well, at least I could do the opening 5 bars before handing the baton over to, say, Murray Pariah or Marta Argerich to continue my good work. They don't look so difficult after all. And now the scales fell with a thud. We had come full circle to more difficult than it looks. But I liked the idea of music which is grateful, in Parham's phrase. Perhaps this equates to a certain ease or easierness. So I ask her to expand on it a bit. It occurs to me, maybe it's obvious, but the people who write the most effect in their piano works also happened to be the greatest pianists of their time. They knew the shape of the hand and what really works. I guess that's why Liszt and Rachmaninoff came out on top of the pieces, which sound challenging to play, but are not so difficult. I could compare the concertos of Grieg and Schumann, too. The former is less technically challenging than the latter. The amount of effort you have to put in to get a very polished, beautiful performance of Schumann is huge. You have to work much, much harder. And Schumann wasn't a performer, of course. It weighed heavily upon him that he wasn't. All very insightful and much to chew on, but I feel I've ended more or less where I started, if perhaps a bit wiser. My only conclusion, therefore, about pieces that are easier than they seem is that they are also as long as a piece of string. One person's ease is another's difficulty. One person's level of ability will never be the same as another's, even at the very top of the pianistic tree. And that what seems easier than expected one day might seem terrifying the next. But that is part of the joy of piano playing, isn't it? Encountering problems, working at them, finding new challenges. The day a piece is really easier than it seems is probably the day you pack up your keyboard and take it to the great concert hall of the sky. So I'll keep struggling with my Liszt, and I'll enjoy the effort for itself as much as for the result. And after all, as Daniel Barenboim once said, you don't get better at something by not doing it. Oh, and do pop into the sanctuary if you're in Lyme Regis, by the way. I didn't clean them out entirely. You've been listening to Classical Music Connection, brought to you each week by the Radio Reading Services of Greater Cincinnati, with generous support from Matinee Musicale Cincinnati. I'm your host, David Hatfield, inviting you to join me next week for Classical Music Connection.